Safeguarding in Sport.
You're listening to the Public Law Podcast, brought to you by the members of 39 Essex Chambers.
Hello, and welcome to the next in our series of safeguarding podcasts, Everyone's Business. Some of you, I'm hoping all of you will know that we've hosted a series of podcasts throughout Safeguarding Adults Week this year. It's our third year where we've been running a series of events and podcasts. So do please take a listen if you can. We've covered a wide range of issues and safeguarding in lots of different contexts. So please do take a moment to listen whenever you can. But today, I'm delighted to be joined by Gillian Sanders. It's not easy to summarise the career history of Gillian, but I'll do my very best. She's a lawyer. She's a 3-times Olympian in the triathlon. She competed in London 2012, Rio 2016 and Tokyo 2020. Post-Tokyo, as if that wasn't enough, Gillian joined Sports Resolutions, where she led on the newly launched UK Sport Integrity Service, which was one of the first of its kind in the UK, an independent confidential reporting line and investigation service for abuse, bullying, harassment, discrimination and more. And Gillian is now the integrity manager at World Sailing, forming part of the legal team and leading on safeguarding, anti-doping and other integrity matters for the International Federation. So Gillian, hello and a huge welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Francesca. Thanks so much for having me here today.
It's an absolute pleasure. And I have to fight my temptation to just ask you lots of questions about competing in the Olympic Games and what that's all about, what the experience was like.
I mean, yeah, it was an awesome experience, but I'm aware that we're under time limitations. So yeah, happy to field your questions.
Maybe another day. Can we start then, Gillian, with how you remember your experiences as an athlete in terms of safeguarding and what the approach to safeguarding was like when you were competing?
Yeah, so to give a bit of context, my career started more or less in about 2010 and then ran through to the delayed Tokyo Olympics in 2021. And I would say for most of the duration of my career, it was pretty non-existent. I think certain behaviors were just tolerated and athletes just got on with things, which is terrible when you think back. I would say in about 2020, that's when safeguarding people started talking about it. I think for me in triathlon, there was a really sad incident that happened with one of the Korean triathletes. She actually committed suicide in 2020. She had been bullied. She'd been psychologically abused. Yeah, and it was an awful incident. So that happened during COVID. The president of the Korean Triathlon Federation, he actually knew about it. He didn't do anything and subsequently was suspended by World Triathlon. But I'd say that's kind of when it started to, for me, I started to notice it a bit more. And then kudos to the IOC, because for the first time at the Olympic Games, I remember prior to Tokyo, we had to complete a mandatory safeguarding course. So yeah, I'd say 2020, 2021, and you'll obviously recall Athlete A, the documentary about the gymnastics abuse that came out during COVID as well, 2020. So I guess we're talking, you know, only about 4 years ago where to me, things started to bubble.
Which is staggering, isn't it? When you think about it, that's just no time at all.
Yeah. And like I said, I think behaviors were just tolerated. I can think of incidents of colleagues of mine, other athletes telling me that their coaches told them they weren't allowed to eat certain things. Their coaches were weighing them. It's awful. It's absolutely awful that behavior was tolerated and still is to some extent these days.
And when you were sort of a young athlete then, and you first started, you said in 2010, were there ever any conversations with you about where to go if you had a concern or who to speak to if something was happening, or was it silence?
I think it was silence. There was no one to go to. I only remember leading into Tokyo. That was the first time where athletes were given an avenue. It almost felt like we had some type of right where we could speak. And I think also with the documentary coming out about the USA Gymnastics, the Larry Nassar abuse scandal as well, I think that really was a turning point where athletes began to start speaking out and having a voice.
And do you think documentaries like that have helped in the sort of wider understanding and knowledge around safeguarding?
Yes, I do, because I think if one athlete speaks out, then it prompts others to do so. I think there's an absolute culture of fear where athletes are terrified about speaking out. I think athletes think there's so much at stake, selection, funding. So silence is the better path almost for athletes because they don't want to create any controversy with a fear of not being selected or their funding being withdrawn, which is terrible because it feels like there's such a power imbalance. So yes, I think those documentaries have helped because they've given athletes more of a voice and I suppose confidence to come forward and speak out and realize that perhaps it's not just them suffering in silence, that there are others as well.
And in terms of training or the guidance in terms of safeguarding that you received as an athlete in advance of Tokyo 2020, so out of the three Olympic Games that you competed in, there was only one where there'd ever been a conversation about safeguarding, is that right?
Yeah.
And did that feel any different then competing in the Games? Was there any change in atmosphere, change in approach, or was it still very early days?
I think it was still early days, but in my head, I was more aware and I think athletes as well began to realize that certain behaviors are not tolerated. So I think the big thing with female athletes, and perhaps we'll talk about it a little bit later, but a lot of the abuse that happens is fat shaming and body image abuse. And I think in the past, that's just been tolerated, you know, in triathlon, for example, gymnastics, swimming, those type of sports where there's a certain idealistic body shape. I think athletes just thought they have to do certain things to look a certain way to be able to perform. And I think that's now starting to shift, which is really positive.
And there's an acknowledgement, isn't there, that actually that approach is abusive and it's damaging psychologically and physically. And I think certainly from what you're saying, it rings true that it was just normalised. That's how female athletes were treated, continue to be in some respects. But part of what I wanted to ask you about today really touches on that, because do you think there has been a different experience for women rather than men in sport to date? And do you think there is an issue from a safeguarding perspective as to how women have or have not been protected thus far?
Feels like women have more of a voice now. With regards to actual initiatives, it still feels like perhaps it's lagging behind. I think the UN or UNESCO recently had a call for action, but it does feel like a lot of talk and no action. To me, it's more that female athletes and women athletes feel like they have more of a voice and more of a confidence to be able to speak out. For example, the sport integrity pilot that I was involved in at Sport Resolutions, I would say 80 to 90% of the cases that we got on that line were female athletes and they were fat shaming, body image, psychological abuse cases. And there were some high profile athletes who began speaking out. So it just felt like athletes were more confident. So initiatives, perhaps not so much, but female athletes feeling like they have more of a voice, yes. So I think there is still a lot of work to be done in this area, but it does feel like it is progressing.
Just looking for a moment then at the sports resolution system that you helped to set up. So does that provide a way for athletes to report things anonymously?
No, they couldn't report anonymously, but the line was confidential and they could do it independently of their federations. So the line was operated or is operated by Crime Stoppers. So if they make a call, then that goes into Crime Stoppers, alternatively to an email address that would then come on to two Sport Resolutions and totally independent. So operating independently of the federation. So no, the athlete did have to identify themselves, but they didn't have to take the matter forward if they didn't want to, which I think is important. So only if they wanted to take the matter further and proceed by way of investigation, then that would be with the consent of that athlete only.
And does that continue to be a well-used resource?
As far as I know, yes. Apparently it is getting busier and busier. I guess the limitation is that it's reserved for athletes on Olympic funding. So the hope for UK sport was to extend that wider, but that's a financial and a funding issue for UK sport. So limited to those athletes on funding. But when I left, it was being used pretty well and growing. And I hear from my colleagues who are still there that it is, which is positive. It felt like when I left that athletes weren't being given enough information by perhaps their federations. I don't know if that was a bit of trepidation on the federation's part, that they were scared that there would be a flurry of cases, that type of thing. So I think more could have been done from that perspective. But yes, it did feel like it was getting better. And as far as I know, it is being used pretty well.
And just touching on something you've said there, so there was a concern or a feeling that athletes weren't being told about the fact that they could report or that there was this resource. Has that been a theme in your experience thus far in safeguarding, that there isn't, or there's a failure to give the athletes the information that they need to actually know where to go, who to speak to and what to do when they have a concern?
Yes, I think so. And I think you just look at the British gymnastics, the White Review. I think no federation wants to be in a situation that British gymnastics found themselves in. So it's a bit of a way up for them, perhaps be transparent, tell the athletes they can report, but at the same time, they have their reputation at stake, funding at stake from UK sport. So ultimately, the athlete should come first. Safeguarding the athletes should come first. But I don't think that's always how it works in practice, because I think there's always federations trying to protect themselves a bit.
And we've had a series of events throughout Safeguarding Adults Week with a number of different professionals from different contexts. And one of the real themes has been, and reflections has been, that there's still a lot of work to be done about the approach being proactive and preventative rather than reactive and protecting the organisation. And I think that goes to really what you're talking about, that if your starting point is to protect the organisation, you're probably failing from the get-go, aren't you, in terms of setting out the information that the athletes would need to know where and who to report to. And of course, there's going to be trepidation. But one of the themes, as I say, that we've been talking about is that if the approach is to protect organisations, health bodies, sporting organisations, then it arguably infects the entire process and how you approach safeguarding as a whole. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And like you say, prevention, that's key, and education is key. You know, if you can get the education and the prevention right, then that solves a lot of problems arising in the first place. And that's where I know we're going to talk later on about my role with World Sailing, but that's what we at World Sailing are trying to do. First of all, we've getting our in-house in order, our education in-house, but we're now extending that to our stakeholders. And we really want to upskill everyone. So people, if they see something, then they report it and we can prevent these things from happening in the first place.
So once you, after the Tokyo 2020 Games, you obviously went and joined Sports Resolutions. When was it then that you decided to join World Sailing?
So yes, joined Sport Resolutions, I guess, was my first job post being a professional athlete. I worked in insurance litigation prior to being a professional athlete back in 2009, 2010. So yeah, I'd always kind of wanted to be involved in sports law. So this was an opportunity that arose with Sport Resolutions, and yeah, joined them, really loved working there. Great bunch of people, still have a great relationship with them, and they're doing some great things, particularly the sport integrity pilots. I love being involved with that and getting that off the ground. And I'm really happy that it is being a well-used service. And I do hope that it does extend beyond the Olympic funding group of athletes. But yeah, I just decided I'd always wanted to work for an international federation in safeguarding. There aren't a lot of international federations based in the UK or out of Switzerland, for that matter. World Sailing is one of those federations that's based in the UK. And yeah, saw the job ad and applied straight away, and yeah, got the opportunity, and I'm really thankful for that.
Fantastic. And then tell us, if you can, then, about your role within World Sailing, because you've had quite a significant part in setting up the safeguarding systems within World Sailing. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I was brought on board particularly for that purpose. So World Sailing didn't have a safeguarding policy in place at all, and we're obviously at risk. We hold a very large Youth World Championships every year. Approximately 400 youth athletes compete in that. Offshore racing is conducive to perhaps abuses taking place with crews offshore for large periods of times in small confinement. So yeah, the federation was at risk, and yeah, I was brought on board to set up the policy. It took almost a year for it to go through the board. Policy and procedure, we've got a separate policy and a separate procedure. And yeah, just really important from a procedural perspective, with independence with regards to the investigation of cases and our disciplinary tribunal. So that was really important to me. And I guess it was a bit of a takeaway from Sport Resolutions. They're very key on their independence. And I think that's something that I took to World Sailing, is we really need to get people who are independent of World Sailing, to investigate the matters. And similarly, our tribunal needs to be made up of people who are totally independent of World Sailing, but obviously really skilled individuals with regards to legal or safeguarding. So yeah, we set that up. The tribunal was put in place earlier this year. And yeah, now everything's there. But like we've said before, it's all good having a shiny policy and procedure in place, but there's the education drive that needs to go with it. And that's the real focus. Now that we've got that policy, we've got the procedures in place, the next focus for the next year is really going to be on the education and also upskilling our federations, so our M&As, and making sure that they all have policies and procedures in place. From a jurisdictional perspective, we would love to take on every case, but that's simply not possible. So our jurisdiction is limited to certain events. And you'll know, obviously, that the M&As will have jurisdiction over their events. A lot of them don't actually have safeguarding policies and procedures in place, particularly in the developing countries. And so, yeah, we're going to be creating templates and, yeah, educating our M&As going forward. And I think World Athletics actually have something in place where it's going to be mandatory for all of their federations to have a safeguarding policy in place by next year. And we hope to also follow that path. It won't be next year, but I think our target will be 2026 to ensure that all of our federations have a safeguarding policy going forward. But yeah, that's where we are. Still lots of work to go.
Yeah, I mean, the work you've been doing is simply fantastic, and it sounds like you really have your hands full going forward. But I do think it's important to note that I think our listeners might be quite shocked to hear that there wasn't a safeguarding policy until you started working for World Sailing, and that there are federations internationally that simply don't have a policy. There isn't a starting point. It really goes back to what you explained at the outset, that it's only really since 2020 that this has been a discussion point. And there's so much work to be done to get these systems in place. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there's been so much silence on it?
I think people are scared, perhaps. I think people are scared of safeguarding. I think they don't really understand what it is. They just hear this word safeguarding. So I think there's maybe a bit of trepidation, resourcing probably in developing countries. They might just not have the resources or skills for a policy, but that's where the international federations should step in. Yeah, I don't think the international federations have an excuse, really. And I think the IOC are doing a good job. They are putting pressure on all of the international federations to put safeguarding policies in place, which is good. But yeah, like you say, it's crazy that some still don't have anything in place. It's ludicrous.
Well, it's probably why we're learning of all of these absolutely awful stories worldwide about what's been happening year on year to young athletes that's gone completely under the radar. One of the things that has been discussed throughout our events over the previous week or so was that, and it feeds into this context really, where there might not be a formal safeguarding policy, but it's what to do in the event of a safeguarding incident, say at the local sports club, at the football clubs, things like that in the community, where either there isn't a formal safeguarding policy or somebody might just not know what to do. And one of the things that has been talked about is the local authority's role in that and the importance of raising the alarm with the local authority. Would you agree with that, particularly in circumstances where there might just be no safeguarding policy in place?
I mean, if that's a last resort, then yes. But I still feel like there's a lot of red tape involved with that. When people hear local authority, I think that puts them off. If people knew that they had someone familiar at a club as the safeguarding officer, that's a much easier way of reporting. So yes, but I don't think it's very user-friendly at all. And insofar as developing countries, so beyond the UK is concerned, I know the IOC is setting up their regional hubs. I think there was $10 million allocated towards that. There's one in Africa, I think based in Southern Africa. You'll have to excuse me because I can't remember where the other two are. I think one is in the Pacific Island somewhere, and I can't remember where the third one is, but one would hope those regional hubs. But again, it's awareness. How do people know how to report in the first place if they're not being given the information? So I think that's a big gap, is just the actual awareness drive, whether, like you say, it's here in the UK, your local football club, or it's somewhere in an African country where people have no idea what to do. So yeah, there is a gap there, and there's a lot of work still to be done. There's a huge gap, isn't there, in terms of the actual person knowing where to report. And then if they did find the person to report to, it's then for the person to know what to do in terms of the safeguarding process. Because I've been involved in lots of cases where essentially the alarm's been raised, but then there isn't a clear process to follow for the safeguarding process. So there needs to be a starting point, which I think goes directly to your point about education, educating people about safeguarding generally, where they need to go, but then also having a really clear policy in place as to exactly what kicks in once that complaint or concern has been raised. And there just seems to be a huge absence of all of that still, certainly at sort of local level.
Yeah, there's a massive gap. There's a massive gap at local level, and it's all over the world as well. So I think the IOC particularly has to think, we've got to get in from the grassroots up, really, and start educating at that level upwards. And I think some thought really has to go into that. And I'm hoping that these regional hubs, there is capacity for them to deliver education. We'll see. It's a really new initiative by them. But yeah, Francesca, there's so much still to be done.
Huge amount of work.
It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah.
But you have a clear plan for at least the next 12 months in terms of education. Is that right?
Yes. So that's our focus. The first focus point was getting our policies and procedures in place, setting up our tribunal. Next process is education and creating some templates for our M&As to use or follow to make sure that they all have a safeguarding policy in place. Yeah, and I guess it'll be our duty as well to make sure that the federations themselves are delivering education to all of their stakeholders. So yeah, that's perhaps the next step for us to encourage them and deliver training to them to be able to deliver education to their stakeholders. So yeah, hopefully organically it's going to grow and the awareness will just go from there.
Excellent. And in terms of the wider acknowledgement of the work that needs to be done, we of course have had the International Olympic Committee consensus statement, which is hot off the press, which looks at interpersonal violence and safeguarding in sport. Do you have any thoughts about that? Have you had the opportunity to absorb it yet?
I've had a brief look at it. For me, I think the main focus is there's athlete-centered. So I think that's really important. I think the IOC have taken action with regards to that at the Olympics with their mental health hubs. So athlete-centered for sure. I've had a look at that. And I think they said there's going to be more scientific research, or has been more scientific research going into it as well. But to be honest, I haven't had a massively detailed look at it. But to me, I think focus points and really positive things was the athlete-centered approach.
Absolutely. And it sort of chimes in, doesn't it, with the approach to safeguarding in terms of the foreign aid crisis internationally, when there was, you know, the significant concerns raised about abuse in the charity sectors. And I remember there was a lot at that time about it being victim-centered. And it comes back to this again, being athlete-centered. And it then, like we said earlier in our conversation, that then makes such a difference to the entire approach to the safeguarding process when it's about the person at the centre of it. And that's come across through all of our discussions over the past week or so, that if you focus on the person at the centre of it, and here in this sporting context, it's the athlete, then you tend not to focus too much on defending either the sports organisation or the body that's involved in the safeguarding process. And you then focus on prevention and a better line of communication. So I was relieved to see that. But I think I was also relieved to see that there is such a significant acknowledgement now that there is this issue, that there is an issue about interpersonal violence and safeguarding in sport, and that something does need to be done internationally. It's certainly clear that that message has got across.
Yeah, and it's really positive that the IOC has put in a lot of work in this space. And like we said at the beginning of this conversation, in 4 years, a lot has happened. And it's really positive that a lot has happened. Like we said, there is a lot more to be done. But I think we also need to acknowledge the fact that a lot of hard work has gone in by the IOC. And they are taking action. They are listening. The athlete-centered approach is really important. So I feel like they are taking that on board. And that's really positive as we head into the future. And yeah, just see what happens the next few years, because I think the space is, it's only the beginning, really.
Absolutely. There's so much to look out for. And I think, like we said earlier, it's so important that we now have the documentaries that we have and the wider conversation that we have to put this on everybody's radar. So we really look forward to seeing the further work that you do at World Sailing. And we'll look out for your progress. But thank you so, so much, Gillian, for joining us today. I know you're extremely busy, so we're very grateful for you for joining us. And for those of you that haven't had the opportunity to listen to our other podcasts yet for Adult Safeguarding Week, please do. They are all on our website, as is the recording from our Safeguarding Question Time, which took place last week. We had an expert panel of speakers, and the recording is now available on the website. So please do have a watch if you can. So thank you for listening, everybody. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. Find our other podcasts and resources over at 39essex.com.